Sunday at the same time.
Senior Focus.
Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to this edition of Senior Focus. I'm Anne-Marie Currie. I'm your presenter and host for the session. And our guest today is Dr. Cathy Irwin, who's a researcher, an academic, and a thought leader, but most especially, her leadership is in the area of women's housing. So without more ado, I'm going to welcome Cathy onto the show and we'll hear from her directly.
Kia ora, thanks Anne-Marie, and hi everybody. My name's Cathy Irwin. I think in a context like this, perhaps my most important way to introduce myself is that I'm a doting grandmother. So my mokopono Rōpata is 10 years old, and he's the centre of my life. And I have two children, a 40-year-old who is a founder and a partner in her own law firm, and a son who's 38 who's been in the banking industry for over 20 years and with the bank he's currently in for 15 years. They're both happily married. We whakapapa to Ngāti Parau, Ngāwhai Pāka and Ngāti Kahumuni to the Orkney Islands. My grandfather on my mother's side came out when he was a child with his father to Scotland and to Ireland. So we descend from the names Takaudu, Cameron, O'Connor and Lawton. So all of that is important in the context of what we're about to talk about. I think most importantly, apart from being a grandmother, I'm a third generation Māori feminist educator. So I currently have a part-time role with the Coalition to End Women's Homelessness. The greater part of my work over my lifetime, my mother's and my grandmother's, has been in education, advancing the way in which education can and does provide both social, cultural and economic platforms for women that are critical in terms of empowerment and advancement. I know that's a long introduction, but it kind of introduces some things about what we're going to talk about today as much as about me as an individual.
Thank you, Cathy. And I too whakapapa to Ireland and Scotland, and also I have a very deep connection with Ngāti Parau. Our two kuia were instrumental in schooling me in te reo and tikanga many years ago, and I've never forgotten their wonderful input. So we shall kick off with how come we're in the middle of this housing crisis? What is the extent of this crisis? And what does it mean? Because, I mean, we've heard the word crisis used for almost 10 years or more. I know I first started using it myself in 2014, was laughed out of a room full of older people who said, no, we don't have a housing crisis, because most of them owned their own home and they thought that was a norm for Kiwis. They did not see it as an issue. And it's gradual, but a number of angles have appeared in the media about this crisis, and I just wondered if we can actually map the territory a little bit for our listeners today.
Yes. So I guess what I'll do is I'll talk about the actual work the Coalition to End Women's Homelessness is currently doing, because we've got a website people can go to, and I'm like you. I'm, you know, a little bit sceptical of the way in which our media is currently being bought by overseas investors. And I'm not too sure just how much control New Zealand has over its own storytelling at the moment. So I am speaking from the basis of the work that the Coalition to End Women's Homelessness has done. And I'm going to talk about research. It's available on our website. You can fact check anything I say today. And I would encourage people to do that, because where we are at right now, if we take our 2024 research in December that looked at homelessness in Aotearoa, New Zealand, our research found that 51% of the homelessness whānau in New Zealand are women. that is extraordinarily high as a percentage, much higher than, for example, overseas in Europe. And a third of those women are Māori women. Now, when you appreciate that Māori women aren't a third of the population in New Zealand, that is a gross disproportionality. Just this year, we followed up with that same group of women, and this is information coming out of the government's own major database. It's called the IDI. It's their data infrastructure. And that follow-up research with the women that we worked with in December 2024 looked at the children of those women and asked about the circumstances of children who are homeless. And from those women, over 57,000 identified in December 2024, 33,000 homeless children emerged in our research. I don't think New Zealanders have a place to go in their hearts and minds to understand 33,000 homeless children, because we don't believe that's the land that we grow up in. We just don't believe that. So we have to be clear, this is the government's own data. It may be a conservative figure, but it is the government's own data out of Stats New Zealand. Stats New Zealand has to formally sign this data out before agencies like ours are allowed to use it. So these are figures verified by the government statistician. 33,000 children, and I'm talking from the ages of naught, so we're talking babies. And you can imagine, in the context of homelessness when you are a child, there are health issues, there are education issues, there are personal safety issues, and we found an inverted comma able to identify, maybe a more sensitive way to describe it, we were able to identify these 33,000 children because we went through the stories of their mothers. So one of the things that we are presented with in social media context at the moment, in the area of the perception of homelessness, and the work that we do particularly, which focuses on women's homelessness, is the pushback we get that homelessness is homelessness. And who's worried about the men, and aren't we worried about the men? Of course we're worried about everybody. We are worried about homelessness in New Zealand as a critical social issue. We are also saying, so it's an and, not an either or. We are also saying there are particular specific issues that women who are homeless face. One of those is children, one of those is health issues, another is the incidence of domestic violence, intimate partner violence and whānau violence that women experience and experience as a contributing factor to homelessness, mental health issues and economic issues stemming from pay equity, from the gender pay gap, the ethnic pay gap that we know is being campaigned widely in our society at the moment. Those factors combine in particular ways to impact women's homelessness differently from men's homelessness. So our work is about saying we are concerned about the whole homelessness community, and we have particular work that we are doing with women's homelessness and with children's homelessness. So when you put all of those things together, for the children, for example, you can imagine, and beyond imagining, you can go to our website to find the facts, but you can imagine that if you're a child who is under five and you are homeless, then registration with a GP is probably not going to be your experience. So access to health services is an issue. Being able to partake regularly in good early childhood education is not likely to be your experience. There are safety issues. So if you are sleeping in a car, if you are sleeping, couch sleeping in a body that has two or three whānau, you may be part of a context in which there are issues of overcrowding and whānau doing their best to be able to cope, but not necessarily having all of the resources and the support that they need. These are issues being rested on children. And what we're saying as a coalition is, and we have three calls to action. Coalition is 3 years old, and it emerged out of a need to be able to create awareness around homelessness in New Zealand, the contemporary context of that, and to be able to call through advocacy for a different response. So the coalition has three calls to action. One is the national strategy on women's homelessness. Two is the need for that strategy and for government agencies to collect VT-centric, gender-disaggregated data. Now, I know that sounds like a mouthful. Isn't data just data? Well, no, it's not. We need particular kinds of data that enable our policy and our thinking and our service design to be more effective. So, for example, you're an older listening group, as am I. I turned 70 this year, so I'm in the retirement income bracket because I'm a person collecting superannuation. KiwiSaver providers are not currently required to collect ethnic data. And so we have no idea what the social and economic and cultural statuses of older Māori living in Aotearoa, because the data is not clear and the data is not clean. Now, in the area of retirement income advice, the Retirement Commissioner has a statutory function to offer that advice to the government once every 3 years. Her latest advice was in November of 2025. And that advice was able to have terms of reference dedicated to considering what happens to women in retirement and retirement income policy. And in that particular frame about the Retirement Income Commissioner being able to specifically investigate and give advice on what happens to women, she also, with her office, has done research in the last two or three years on the gender difference in KiwiSaver balances. And in the first research that the office put out, the difference was about 20%. And in some of the latest research, that difference has gone to 25%. And so as the Retirement Commissioner, she is able to give advice that is more fine-tuned and specific, because she has the data available to her, to enable her advice to be accurate. You can imagine that if no data is collected at the ethnic level, she is not able to give effective, specific advice on retirement income policy for Māori, for Pacific people, for Asian people, because the data needed to inform her advice doesn't get gathered. Now, you have every right to say to me, are you sure? Because I used to work for the Retirement Commission. I worked for the Retirement Commission at the time the 2022 advice was being prepared. So from 2020 to 2022, I was the kaihautū in the Commission's office. So I have an understanding of its work. I wrote to the Financial Market Authority, the FMA, last year to have this question of whether the KiwiSaver providers collect ethnic data confirmed in writing, one way or the other. And they came back to me and confirmed, absolutely, KiwiSaver providers do not collect ethnic data. So one of the calls for the coalition then is, we're saying, the data gathering needs to be more sophisticated, and that's why it says Te Reti Centred Gender Disaggregated, so you know what the situation is for European men and women, what the situation is for Māori men and women, what the situation is for Pacific men and women. You see the pattern. if the data is not both gender and ethnic disaggregated, we will have less sharp measures available to us in that policy advice area. And the third of our calls is that we believe that housing policy should be approached from a gendered base, so that when housing policy is being developed, it is thinking about particular needs of women, specific needs of women in the way in which that housing policy is formulated. So those are our three calls.
Yes, and that makes just so much sense. Thank you very much for being so clear and articulating these three calls so effectively, Kathy. And further to data, we could discuss about the disappearance of the census, because the latest suggestion is that the census could be done away with. Yes. And I think that would be a great blow to not only our understanding of our social landscape, but there's no equivalent or no other sources that would actually replace it effectively.
Yeah. So I'm in agreement with you, and in fact the Coalition, like others, made submissions on the process through which consideration was undertaken by the government about whether to retain the census or to cancel it. And I'm not withstanding the fact that there have been issues with our census. But what's critical about it is that it gives the government, or it gave the government, a stronger platform to be able to strategically plan and deploy the economic, the social and the cultural resources of our society for the betterment of our society. Because that, in my view, so I guess I have a particular view of government. I see government as a very powerful part of helping our society be the best it can be. And I guess my parents are both teachers, and my grandparents, my grandmother was a teacher, my grandfather was a Presbyterian minister. So I've clearly been brought up in a household that is focused on pay it forward, be of service, live a value-based life. That means that if you receive more in your life, you build a bigger table so that more people can sit with you to share the resource. If you receive more in your life, you don't open two more bank accounts to deposit it for yourself. So that's just how we were brought up. And in that space, I see government having a critical role in enabling us as a society to be our best. And that's the challenge. I'm not a politician. I've been asked to be a politician many times. I don't want to be a politician. I'm happy being an educator. So I don't want that job, which means probably I shouldn't have so many opinions about it. But I do, because I'm a citizen. And citizens are allowed to have opinions about our government. In a democracy anyway, it's a part of our citizens' rights. So I am about being able to see how functions like the census enable us to have as strong an evidential base as is possible. Our Stats New Zealand and our census has also done some interesting things in the Māori development space. So some years ago, and I think it was around 2013 or 2014, Stats New Zealand introduced a new tool called Tukupinga. And what Tukupinga did was it gathered more data, more sophisticated data from the Māori population about language use, about cultural development, about giving to the community, about voluntary labour, all sorts of ways of trying to make more sense of how Māori live in Aotearoa, in this current part of our history, and how we live, the kind of contribution we make economically, socially, culturally. The figures around Te Kukunga that came out were absolutely fascinating and gave a confirmation to people like me of what we know to be the case because it's the life we live, that there is a very generous and positive contribution made to our society by Māori that has largely been under the radar in our society for a long period of time. So people can genuinely not really be sure what contribution Māori make to our society. And Kupinga was one of the tools that fell out of the census that helped us be clearer about that. Internationally, it's recognised as a unique and innovative data-gathering tool at the national level in the Indigenous states. So the people who were the designers and the researchers and the analysts at Te Kupinga have been flown all around the world by different governments to talk about it because it's been seen as so helpful and so innovative. Just to speak to that one idea about the visibility of Māori society that Te Kupinga helps us to understand better, where people are seeing our society contribution more now is during emergencies, when marae are opening doors, during floods, during climatic events, during the Christchurch earthquake, for example. The marae in Wellington, Pipitia marae in Wellington, mobilised and was set up ready to receive the plane loads who came from Christchurch under urgency out of Christchurch to Wellington for respite care. That marae was set up for a considerable period of time to be of service and to receive whānau. A similar thing happened with the earthquakes in Edgecombe. Our research suggests to us that marae in Edgecombe around the Whakapānia district mobilised faster than the Red Cross when those earthquakes hit. We saw the same thing in Kaikoura. We have seen the same recently in the last 12 months. As a result of the climatic event. So what those events show is, again, the very old generosity, the manaakitanga, the aroha, that our Māori cultural infrastructure, the hidden part of our society that people don't often see, pops up into public view, especially in times of crisis. So I guess our concern is, Māori is, that if the Crown moves to take away those significant ways in which it gathers data at a national level about its own people, then it's going to be harder for policy and services to be able to be designed effectively, is my view, in the absence of that kind of data. So I am concerned. I'm not a statistician, but I know the power that good approaches to understanding quantitative data can have when people are making the case for policy development, for service development, and for ways in which the allocation of our taxes, which we all pay, can be undertaken in a fair and equitable manner.
Yeah. And moving on to the housing strategy, the solutions, because I think we've got the landscape now really mapped out, and we also know that data collection's got to be a vital part of any solution gathering and any progress monitoring. And that's, you know, I can't see how you can be blind in a fog if you haven't, if you haven't got the data, you're going to be walking blindfolded or walking through fog. You won't know whether you've been making any difference or what kind of a difference you're making. So it seems to me that a responsible manager, as the government needs to be, it needs to have quality data. It's got to be a foundation of what solution they may propose. So, yep, we've nailed that. Let's look at the actual type of housing that's available, because we've got a huge mismatch between people in need and what's out there. We've got places boarded up. They haven't been lived in for many years, that the government hasn't dealt to the situation. We have got places being built by developers, and they're sitting empty because there isn't the infrastructure, there isn't the water supply connected, there isn't the proper planning in place to allow people to live in these places. And some of these places, we've had up to 1,500 of them in Auckland just sitting empty.
Yeah,
because of this mismatch in the environment and poor planning around what is needed. We've got community providers actually doing some quite interesting housing developments and quite positive, and they are based around need, and they're trying to provide something that's affordable and accessible. But they aren't all accessible, and just as Housing New Zealand or Kāinga have been building some new places, their record with accessibility is relatively low. I think I've heard figures as high as 15%, but on average it seems to be more like 11%. But would you like to talk about accessibility and affordability? What, you know, would be your view of what could be provided?
Thank you for the opportunity. I think I'd like to talk about housing at the sector level and then come down through a couple of layers to land in the space where we can talk about accessibility and housing solutions. Because, you know, what is happening at the moment is that iwi are investing significantly in housing development. And I guess in asking me the question, my natural place to come from in response is from a Māori development place, because you're asking me. And so around the country, for example, just in the last 2 years, you can see notices of $51 million of investment in the far north, about $50 million around the Maniapoto area. I'm from the Tairāwhiti, and there's a development in the Tairāwhiti, about $75 million, over $45 million of which was contributed by iwi. So this is not all government money. This is iwi investment. And the village in the Tairāwhiti is a very interesting one from our point of view in the coalition space, and also mine as a Māori grandmother. Okay. We're being told to wrap up. So just quickly, that initiative in the Tairāwhiti gives you an insight into a number of issues. So iwi investment number one is greater than the Crown's investment. So this is not all about government money. Number two, there are 150 houses in a gated community that is going to prioritise women and children.
Fantastic.
There is going to be somebody on call 24 hours a day in that community. So the principle here is, when you let local people design what they need according to the specifics of their local communities, you get better strength-based outcomes. And I think that little village in the Tairāwhiti.
Yeah, thank you. You didn't put the clock up, so that didn't help. But never mind. Okay.
Just to close off, that village in the Tairāwhiti is something to watch. Local development, local need, local strength.
Kia ora. Thank you very much, Kathy, for your precision and clarity. And we look forward to hearing from you again later this year.
Kia ora. Ngā mihi. Thank you for the opportunity.
Aye. And kia ora to our listeners, and we'll see you, we'll have you with us next week. Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus,
if you're disabled,
is one word.
You have a unique perspective. This is your POV, and it's important. In this ad, a synthetic voice was used to mirror the accessibility tools used by some disabled people. The Election Access Fund provides money for assistive tech like this, recognizing that disabled people often face additional costs when standing as candidates in elections. The fund assists with these costs.